Welcome, everybody. My name is Philippe Beaulieu-Brossard, and I am the co-president of the Archipelago of Design, the leading international group on design and foresight for national security purposes across NATO members and partners. And today, it's an honor to relaunch the Tension podcast series with a special guest, Dr. Ben Zwabelsen, who's now based at US Spacecom as the director of the Strategic Innovation Group. Welcome, Ben.
Philippe, thanks for having me. I'm Ben Zwabelsen, and really excited to be here. Of course, this podcast, I will be talking as a private citizen and astute design academic. And of course, none of my views stated today represent or reflect the Department of Defense, U.S. Space Command, or the United States government. They are just mine and mine alone, particularly the ones that are offensive.
Excellent. Let's bring the offensive today. And of course, full disclaimer, these views do not represent the views of our respective organizations, of course. So again, I mean, the concept of tension is that we explore tension between opposite concepts or oppositions in our own community to, you know, challenge them and perhaps get to something new. And what is awesome is that today it's a special podcast because in 10 days from now or so, your first book is going to be released with Routledge. And we're here to celebrate a bit this this milestone for you. And it's awesome. You told us that it's, you know, 7 years of your work life that was put into this, and we're going to have the expression of this. So today with you, I would really like to dig more into the tensions that you've been inquiring in your book to really flesh them out. And I think it's going to give us like a deeper understanding of design across NATO members and partners. But before we do that, why don't we talk a bit about yourself? So you were not, let's say, a theoretical designer all of your life. What made you first take it seriously?
Well, I think, and I talk a little bit about this in the foreword to my book, where I explain kind of how did I get into this, why am I here, how did this all happen. But I started out as a kid, as a child, as an artist. I was, you know, that kid in your class that could draw really well and was kind of the artsy fartsy person. You know, that was me through all of the schools, and I was bombarded in high school with, Ben, you must go to art school. You must be a fine artist. Don't waste your talent. I really wanted to be a marine ecologist, but it never happened. So who knows? Maybe in another lifetime I would have been that. But I went to University of Connecticut to get a degree in graphic design and fine arts, and then I had to pay for college. And up until that point, I said I was never going to join the military. I didn't like the idea of the military. I didn't like the idea of somebody telling me what to do. But I needed money for college. So next thing you know, I'm in the National Guard. It's paying for my college. And I had this weird overlap of the artist, the creative, the divergent, and then the military with the discipline, the uniformity, the reliability, the persistence. And I got in trouble in both worlds. I got in trouble in the military an awful lot for thinking differently, thinking creatively, challenging. But I also got into trouble, if you will, in academics, in fine arts, for having these different perspectives that were, military is largely unpopular in a lot of what we do. So that's how I ended up sort of into this. And, you know, the book is a different story, so I'll stop there.
Yeah, but I think the book is a great, let's say, expression of this this story, right? Because you require a lot of discipline to come up to this and to publish it to this standard. So, and at the same time, you need the creativity to really pull that off. So I think that's perhaps a great product that archaeologists will, you know, find out in 1,000 years, say yes. I mean, that's a good milestone. But yeah, let's go straight into the book. So what motivated you to write a book about military design across NATO members and partners? Of all the topics that you could have go for, why did you pick that one?
So I love using complexity science to articulate really, really difficult things in a certain way. And emergence is one of my favorite words. And when I talk to the military about emergence, it's difficult because we're so goal-oriented. We always want end states and strategic ends and goals and objectives. And we want everything to line up with ways and means. And we want to be able to manage it in this beautiful way that everything is just blindingly obvious before we start. And the whole thing with emergence is no. Complex dynamic systems are not going to let you do that. And in fact, something that's entirely outside of the limits of your imagination is really what's going to happen, and you will deal with the consequences of your lack of imagination. And that's why I made a book, is because I didn't plan on writing a book. I had no interest in writing a book, just as I had no interest in joining the military, just as I had all these things kind of just happen. And as they're happening in the moment, it suddenly makes sense. And when I started my PhD journey, I had already been studying and working in design since I had attended the U.S. Army School of Advanced Military Studies, or SAMS, in Fort Leavenworth. And for me, it was a double-edged sword. I was at the midpoint of my officer career, and they send you to SAMS, the lucky few or the unlucky few, perhaps, if you qualify for this advanced education. And it's supposed to impart you with this incredible depth of planning and strategy. And when I went there, there was design. And I get into that in the book on what happened at Leavenworth. But I got exposed to the design bug, and it bit me hard. And suddenly, all the things that I had been getting in trouble with as a fine artist who joined the Army was now making sense, because now I could convey that creative energy into a targeted way that resonated with strategic and operational practices and theory and doctrine. And so it set me off on a journey that got me in more trouble as a field grade officer, but it also kind of opened my eyes to, my goodness, this is something that I really enjoy, I'm good at, I really want to contribute this way, maybe this is what I need to do. So I took the option of retiring after 21 years and used my GI Bill to pay for my doctoral program. And so it's a funny side story, but the senior enlisted leadership at Spacecom, both of them that I'm very good friends with, they use me as their poster boy now, because I accidentally told them that I used the military to pay for my undergraduate, and then the Army had me go to 3 different master's programs. That was completely accidental, and it all was free. And then I finished my doctorate, and they're like, look at Dr. Z up there, to say he did everything with the government, and they're right. But I didn't plan any of that, nor did I plan the book. And so what happened with the book was, I wrote my first couple chapters of my thesis 7 years ago, and it was terrible. It was absolutely terrible. So for advice for people that want to write a book, if you think that you can write like The Great Gatsby in a weekend and it's going to be beautiful, yes, like 3 people in the world are able to do that. The rest of us can't. I'm one of the bottom percenters that had to write my book at least 20 times. And throughout the 7 years, each time I wrote a chapter, I was like, I'm done. This is good. This is good enough. I love it. And then you'd go back to it, or you learn something new, or someone would review it, and you're like, okay, throw it out, start again. And each time I did it, I kept thinking, I'm done. I'm finally done. After some time, though, you had this love-hate relationship. And I think authors out there that have done this know what I'm talking about. But it finally got to a point about a year and a half ago, where I was like, my goodness, I think this could actually publish and it won't be embarrassing. And the last couple of refinements and reviews through Routledge were fantastic. And now the book is done. But even all the way up into the end, I kept looking at pages and sections going like, no, that's terrible. How that survived 20 different iterations and still was there, I don't know what I did. So this is terrible advice for anyone that wants to write a book. It's going to be long and painful, and it's iteration after iteration after iteration. But really, you know what? That's what the creative process is, and that's what design is, and that's what innovation is. And our defense culture lacks the appetite for that, because we want those quick results. We want the book in a weekend. But the reality is, if you want something that's really good, or I hope is good, when you read my book, it's 7 years of smashing my head against the wall and finally having something that makes a lot more sense now.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was going, is that this story is a great design story, right? Is you need not only a great vision, but also a lot of persistence to really get it, you know, out and on a shelf, right? And you picked like a very demanding topic, right? Because you're taking us, the reader, not only to understand the dimensions between like a commercial understanding of design in contrast to a more military understanding. Then you take us through time from the pre-modern to the post-modern era. And then you take us around the world from Israel to the US, Canada, Australia, and in the UK. So I think it's a very ambitious a book that you just pulled off. And what is fantastic, it's that now we've been waiting for such a resource, right, to build on for all of the other projects, research, curriculum development, and now thanks to you, we have it. That's fantastic. And you're right. I think that for any such project, you should not really go what you're getting into. A bit like running a marathon or perhaps having children, you should not know exactly what you're getting into. Otherwise, you would not do it. So yeah, I think you need the vision and you need the discipline to just go on and keep on going, unless even if you break your neck along the way. So I think it's a very inspiring story. To go to the topic of tension. So I mentioned a couple of them because in the book, the way you structure your book, you do a lot of let's say comparison between you explore tension between opposites, like design for commercial purposes versus design for military or organizational purposes, design versus planning, Israel and American approaches to design, so on and so forth. So it may have been unconsciously, but can you tell us why did you structure some of the components of your book that way, with tensions like at the forefront?
So this is a book, and it's a story. It's a meta story or meta narrative about a whole bunch of different groups of human beings that absolutely do not want to listen to anyone else. And you're, I know this will make you laugh a bit, but I would encounter non-military and military groups throughout my career that would absolutely not talk to each other because for a variety of different reasons, whether it's your belief system or your paradigm, your social paradigm of reality of what a nation ought to do or not ought to do. And so this gets very political. There's a lot of culture and ideology and sociology here. But even within academia, you as a postmodernist know that mainstream academia versus postmodernism, they won't be in the same room with each other. And then ironically, many postmodernists won't be in the same room with other postmodernists. And the same thing happens in design, where I encounter these tribes. I come from the IDEO school, or I come from the Human Center, or I come from Stanford, or I come from Scrum, or I'm an agile person, or enterprise design thinking is my way or the highway, or the British double diamond or die. And this is fragmented throughout the design community. There's another fragmentation or tension, if you will, between designing for commerce and products to include tools of war. So when we have a new helmet, a new weapon, a new jet fighter, those things are designed by commercial designers in the military-industrial complex. But military organizations who have to do security activities in war, they struggle because they have a very set way of thinking about action and creativity and thought and change, and it doesn't mesh with commerce and the design of new products. And so there's these tensions there. And then, of course, you mentioned the international one. So you have Israel, which is where military design first started. And I talk about that in my book on maybe why that happened that way. There's a lot of geopolitical reasons. But then you have the American military and how they started embracing design, but also changing it, distorting it in many ways for the Israeli inventors, doing things that weren't design or were bastard children. And then you have design expanding. Of course, here we are in the Canadian Forces College in its historic building doing this wonderful podcast. There's a beautiful bar right across from me, but it's not open yet, so I can't have a steam whistle until later. But in Australia, where I'll be in a week and a half, there's a design culture there, and it's struggling, but it's still growing. And these are the things that I kind of try to address in my book. Which is fascinating because I hope my book is read by each of these groups, but the odds are it could not be, because if you're a commercial designer and you see a book written by a military practitioner that says understanding the military design movement, you may immediately say, well, I'm dismissive of that. Not even knowing that there's an entire chapter exploring the relationships here. And simultaneously, if you come from a design school or a military service that espouses a particular doctrine of design, you may also put your hand up and say, absolutely not. And for the postmodernists out there, unless you really stimulate them with some of the sources that we use, they might immediately dismiss this as something that's entirely wrong.
All right. So of all the tensions that you are unpacking in your book, like which one is the most important one to understand design? Is it form and function?
That's a great question. And what I would say is, like, for me personally, in all my experience with design, the most formidable obstacle for any designer and working with the organization is being aware or reflective of our own frame, on how we look at reality, on how we make sense of who we are, what we do, why we do what we do. Because if we can't do that, we get stuck in these institutional practices of non-thinking, because they're frankly more efficient. And we all experience this throughout the day. If you've ever driven your vehicle and you get lost in thought, and then suddenly you're a few miles down the road, but you were driving perfectly. Right? Your body was doing it, but your brain wasn't there. Institutions want us to do this all the time because it's simply more efficient. But when we do this in the military application for war, for defense, for security, we go on autopilot cognitively, and we're not aware of the limits and the consequences of us just using our frame. And we tend to project it upon others. And we don't anticipate what are the differences between us and an adversary that doesn't use our frame or uses a different one that's intention. And to do design within your own frame means you're making new things that'll make your organization happy. You're giving it what it wants, but you're not giving it what it needs. To get to what we need, we have to be able to move beyond our frame. And that's truly where innovation occurs. And that's also why it's really hard.
That's fascinating. And but again, for the first place, for let's say some people, civilians like myself, it may be already surprising that, you know, military organizations that are seen in a very pejorative way as extremely conservative, that there was like a crack open to at least experiment with it in historical episodes that you cover very well in your book. So if you look at, you know, all of these historical episodes in your book, like what is the key trigger that made these organizations at least give it a chance?
That's one word: failure. Failure is the only way that an organization, a military, is willing to change its ways. I think Little Hart had a great line that I hear one of my good friends and mentors, Jim Greer, over at Sam's likes to quote Little Hart, in that the one thing harder than getting an idea into the military is getting it out. And it's Little Hart is brilliant there, and he's talking about the institutionalization of military organizations for a reason, and that's, of all the enterprises that human beings as a species do, there's nothing more dangerous, deadly, or destructive or taxing on the human imagination than war. And I'm not a proponent of war by any means, but I acknowledge that our entire civilization, the history of our species on this planet, has had several things that are always there, no matter where you look, no matter where you look in the world, no matter which tribe or group or original human civilization was there. There's language, there's religion, there's art, and there's war and politics. I mean, these things exist everywhere permanently. And while there could be the opportunity for us to rise above and settle our differences without organized violence, I'm not an idealist either. You know, these are things that are going to continue. What's important, and I think I try to get at this in the book, is if we continue to do the wrong things right, we only get more wrong. And that's a Russell Acuff quote, and I love it. Because if we continue to do our strategy, our operational planning, how our institutions prepare and professionalize people to think and act and lead in war, and we keep leaving all these things out, or we keep doing old, outdated practices without thinking about why we do it, other than shut up and color. Or whenever I ask a college, a population, just like this morning, why do we believe in levels of war? And everyone kind of looks at you with this like blank-eyed, like, well, because they're real. Of course. But why? Why do you believe that? Where did that come from? Why is it levels of war? Why isn't it something else? Some of those things seem philosophical, artsy-fartsy, and a waste of time, but they also could be illuminating the straitjackets that cognitively are choking our organizations from thinking anything but what we've been told to do. And so design has tried in military organizations to do that. to varying degrees of success and failure. The Israelis, in my two Israeli chapters, they met with profound failure right before the Hezbollah war with experimenting with the original systemic operational design in Shimonave and the Otri Institute. The United States military, the Australian military, the Canadian military, the British military were all embroiled in a counterinsurgency in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so they later experimented with design and had different failures and different frustrations, which caused them to do different things, which I explore in each of my books or each of my chapters in the book. And then ultimately where we are today, there isn't one way to do military design, just as there's not one way to do commercial design. It's very context dependent, but I would still say that there's a very unhealthy seesaw between how we teach and understand planning as well as strategy in the traditional IR sense and how we're looking at design and innovation, creativity, and change. They're not working well, and it's not a good mix in our professional education, nor is it a good mix in our military leaders as they go through the ranks.
Now, I just want to go back to your books and to the, this travel of, you know, the Israeli design experiment, and as you label it in your chapter, as design comes to America, in a nod of the Prince of New York. So I was wondering, there was a lot of tensions, you know, between the American culture, especially the U.S. Army culture, receiving, you know, let's say the first Israeli concepts of design coming in. So where do you see in your book, in your research, the greatest tensions when the U.S. Army got, you know, these early Israeli concepts?
Yeah. What's interesting about that is there's some uncomfortable truths. And so if you go back to Shimonave and in the original systemic operational design or SOD, so he developed this in the mid-1990s in Israel. And unlike commercial design, which developed earlier, but it developed in a different form and function, and it really, commercial design did not inspire Nave. He was drawing inspiration from his study of operational art and predominantly he saw it in the Soviet work. And really saying Soviet is tricky here because most of the theorists that were developing Soviet ideas on operational art in the 1920s and 30s were actually leftovers from the earlier Tsar army that had switched sides, and this is Stalin took care of that in the 1930s and purged most of them, including Svechin and his adversary. But Nave was looking at that and looking at how the Soviets were the first really to look at systemically warfare in a different way. But he was also blending in complexity theory, general systems thinking, and postmodern philosophy. Now, postmodern philosophy is the one ingredient that I think is the most powerful. It's also the most misunderstood. It's also the most difficult to integrate because it's very difficult. It's antagonistic to most everything that we have in our military as well as our traditional academic curriculum, right? And so what happened in the American Army and the American Marine Corps, which are the two that I studied the most, then there's two chapters on each, is that the complexity theory was very readily accepted, and many of the early adapters of Nave's kind of look at military design, a lot of them had already looked at systems thinking, that they were working some of the, in the 1980s, John Boyd's work very much tied into complexity theory, general systems thinking, systems analysis, networks, the effects-based operations that was popularized in the 1990s as a targeting methodology, started from systems thinking and some elements of complexity science. So you had these adapters that were looking at this, but then they were confronted with, you need to learn postmodern philosophy. And most of them put their arm up and Heismaned it. They balked. They said, no. Some did. And for those few that did, I think they really harnessed what design could do, but most did not. And the doctrine that came out of the American Army and the American Marine Corps during the fertile period where design was really working and churning in the early 2000s reflects this surgical removal of the things that we don't want. And then we basically took complexity science and assimilated it into this earlier Newtonian framework and stripped away even the theory behind that. And that's why you'll have linear, nonlinear, and emergence sprinkled about in our planning, but it's devoid of any context because everything becomes linear. Every problem becomes solved. Every end state becomes achieved in our logical framework because it's not complexity science anymore. It's Newtonian mimicry that espouses the last three centuries of how we've structured, how we look at organization and war.
Excellent. And I think that we find this this turbocharger metaphor in the accelerator, like, you know, Diana for NATO and all of the others. It's basically we're here to accelerate in terms of optimization and all that, but it's not really about, you know, creating something new, something that is needed.
Well, we want speed because in the physical domains that we're used to for warfare, but also for everything else, speed equals good, right? It's a principle of war from Jomini, and it dates much before Jomini as well. I mean, you can go back into ancient Greek discussions of natural philosophy, which weren't necessarily about war. They dealt with a lot of other things, but the war would be in there. Yeah, and you can go to Sun Tzu as well and find some elements of where, look, this is a physical domain thing where human beings understand, I've got to be able to maneuver, I've got to be able to be fast, I need to utilize power. And of course, Sun Tzu and Greek logic, very, very different. Julian provides some incredible stuff here. But today, we still are obsessed with speed, but we don't understand that speed itself may change with some of the technological event horizons we're about to encounter. Artificial intelligence and how we have human-machine teaming. AI is already moving faster than we can think, but we still remain largely in control or in some sort of supervisory relationship. And we have to design differently because human beings will be behind the decision-making loop very quickly. And what I mean by that is that artificial intelligence, as it becomes more sophisticated and more towards a general intelligence, will gain more and more abilities that we are unable to keep up with. And we generally may not be able to recognize unless the AI explains it to us explicitly. And then this begs the question of, we normally understand warfare in certain time periods and locations and actions that are understood historically by human beings in human time and space. We don't understand things in nanoseconds. We don't understand things in light years. I mean, we say we do, but we really can't comprehend, just as we can't comprehend astronomical numbers, trillions, quadrillions, right? AI can do these things. So what happens when warfare is manifested in such ways that are beyond human comprehension, but have very real consequences that we have to live in later on?
Yeah, this brings me to my my last question. So what are the tensions that remain to be engaged and challenged in design for security purposes that, you know, that would require a sequel to your book? And I think you just touched on it about the tension between the development of technology and the gap with the development of our conceptual capabilities and all that. So, you know, how do we address this this gap? Like, is there anything that we can do to keep up?
Well, so, you know, my book's coming out this year in just a couple of days. So when you hear this podcast, head over to you know, Amazon or Rutledge and look up Understanding the Military Design Movement. And it's 2023, so let's go 20 years in the future, 2043. And what I would imagine is a sequel to the book, if it was to be done then, would have to address all the things that may happen in the next two decades that are going to be transformative. So I'm not going to talk about the things that still will be there. Like, we'll still have nuclear weapons. We'll still have a navy. We'll still have submarines. We'll still have cities. We'll still have transportation, right? But all those things will change, and some of the things will change so much so that people in 2040, if they dig this podcast up, we'll probably laugh at some of the things I'm about to propose, but also say, wow, he wasn't too far off on some of these things. And I'm not being original here. There's a lot of great futurists that have already talked about this stuff ad nauseum. One is quantum. So quantum theorists already, researchers already say that when you have a large enough quantum computer, you're going to be able to break all the standard encryption that we have. So ATM cards, bank accounts, everything, it's all going to be broken. And so that's a challenge. It's like, all right, well, at some point, the cat is out of the bag, and you've got to have everything quantum encrypted, which means that if we go to that and adversaries also go to that, neither of us can ever crack the other's side, right? So, and that's the laws of physics, right? And there's a lot of good YouTube videos and stuff out there on quantum. But the thing is, we really haven't scratched the surface on that as a military, and we don't take it seriously because, oh, that's too far in the future. I already talked about AI, but AI is going to do lots of things well beyond chatbot. All right, so chatbot is a problem right now, and look what it's doing in our society. Well, guess what? Virtual reality, augmented reality, artificial intelligence is operating well beyond our imagination, is coming soon, and it's going to change so many things. A lot of these challenges between now and 2040 have to deal with ethics and morals. What is our society willing to do as a people, as a culture, and what are we willing to do for our defense? Are we okay with genetically modifying babies or fetuses so that we can create super soldiers? Probably not. I mean, that's very unsettling for most of us, right? What about our adversaries? Do you think for a moment that if it was going to give you a significant advantage, that an adversary that doesn't have those qualms would go and do that? Because talking with a Silicon Valley high-level person the other month, he talked about how a future tank should have 50 drones in front of it and 50 drones behind it. Because before that tank does anything, a whole bunch of those drones need to go out and probe and reconnaissance and do all kinds of things and maybe even solve the problem before the tank even sees it. Because an expendable, cheap drone that can go and do automated what a human being might be in trouble or threatened by is the way of the future. Now, whether or not that person's right, what I think is a human being who is able to, the average person, we can think about 6 or 7 things at once. We're not multitaskers, no matter how much we insist we are. If you could boost the intelligence of a soldier to where they could track 40 things at once, think about that combat advantage, right? Now, how do you boost it? Now, Nick Bostrom talks about this in his book, Superintelligence, and I'm not going to belabor all of his points, which are wonderful, and I highly recommend that book. But there's a nanotechnology, there's genetics, there's bio, there's cybernetics, there's all sorts of different things that you can do, or there's just straight up artificial intelligence. These are the things that are going to be happening in the next 20 years. So if there's a second book, it probably would deal with what kind of world is that now, and how are humans probably in some sort of new teaming with artificial or augmented life, how are they dealing with the threat of security and defense? Many of these things will have echoes of what we see today. You can't get away with the physical domains. Destroying something means you destroy it, right? But there's so many things that will be much more pronounced in 2040 than today, particularly virtual reality or augmented reality, that destroying something there matters so much more, right? Or controlling and manipulating things there. And the last thing I'd throw out is that I think I have a concept I'm working on phantasmal war. And that is war that exists and occurs beyond human comprehension. So I'll just leave the viewers with like a tidbit. So there's some work I'm doing, and I'll probably put some on Medium or draft concepts out later on social media. But technology is going to be able to make us able to do things that we can't imagine right now, or we have a hard time understanding, because it goes beyond a bullet fired by a human that hits a target, right? We're very good at that. We're not good at understanding things that are well beyond that sophistication level, but AI and all this technology, all these things are going to allow these different ways, unfortunately for us, different ways of organized violence, because that's probably not going away. We're just going to be more exquisite and peculiar in how we do it. And potentially a war that's virtual or beyond our comprehension even of the average person could unfold in a nanosecond and have incredible consequences that some humans might not even understand or realize or even recognize as war. And this is really troubling because we keep pointing to the past. We keep looking at monuments, and we keep looking at museum pieces, relevant, and those are important. They're part of our history, but they don't necessarily point towards the future. They may just be what was important then and is no longer relevant tomorrow.
So to wrap this up, thank you so much, Ben. Again, it's always fantastic to have you here in Toronto at Canadian Forces College, and to try to follow the wild mind that you have. And thank you so much for attempting to unpack all of this I would say emerging design tradition in the military. You really developed a book that we needed. This is not what let's say as we put it, that organization wanted, but that's what they needed. And I think that when they will have it in their hand, they will discover that this is really what we needed. So everybody go to amazon.ca or your bookseller and order by Ben's Babelson, Understanding the Military Movement.
And then also, if you're in the military or civilian, your librarian can absolutely secure hard copies, I'm sure, through the system.
Yep. So thanks so much, and I wish you a great continuation of your trip in Canada, your design pilgrimage, and I look forward to see you for another episode of Tension. Thanks so much. Goodbye.
Thank you.